This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, July 27th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, as the 2012 Olympics start with a lavish opening ceremony in London, protesters bring attention to labor rights, corporate influence, and restrictions on public space.
The Olympics is about taking land, and it means removing the people who were there, the East Londoners, the jobs that were there, the facilities that were there.
As the International Conference on HIV/AIDS wraps up in Washington, D.C., advocates call for action to address one of the groups hardest hit by the disease, gay black men. And we'll go to the Philippines, where local communities say a new government policy on mining fails to rein in an industry long criticized for damaging the environment and threatening residents. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. The U.S. State Department says tank columns are moving into Syria's second city, Aleppo. Air attacks have also been reported, and many see these early assaults as the beginning of a serious escalation in President Bashar al-Assad's 17-month crackdown. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports from the Turkish-Syrian border.
Footage shot by activists in Aleppo shows what appears to be a helicopter gunship strafing the city with machine guns.
Helicopters are shelling in everywhere in Aleppo, in every area, especially the areas which is under Free Syrian Army control.
That's the voice of Mohammed Saeed, a 25-year-old activist with the Syrian Revolutionary General Commission, talking via Skype. The heavy fighting reported today is feared to be just the beginning. Meanwhile, a 26-year-old volunteer relief worker, who gave his name as Abu Al-Jud, says residents are suffering from extreme shortages.
Most of the shops are closed from like 6 days ago, and there is no gas and no fuel for cars and no bread.
Aleppo had been relatively calm for much of the past 17 months, with many of its wealthier districts largely remaining loyal to President Bashar al-Assad. Consequently, many people have moved into the city for safety. But with the revolt spreading to urban areas, that's changed, says 26-year-old activist Mohammed, who declined to give his full name.
Aleppo is very busy. Like, so many people moved from the countryside to the city, and so many people moved from other cities around to Aleppo. So a very huge humanitarian issue is coming soon.
Rebel fighters of the Free Syrian Army have occupied numerous neighborhoods, apparently with popular support in the poorer districts. Today's attacks appear to be a serious attempt to dislodge the rebel fighters and bring the city back under government control. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Antakya, Turkey.
Ecuador says it will announce its decision whether to give asylum to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange after the Olympics. Assange has been taking refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London since mid-June. He went there after a judge ruled he would be extradited to Sweden to face questions for sexual misconduct. But Assange's fear is that Sweden will then extradite him to the U.S., where he would likely face charges for publishing sensitive documents. Ecuadorian officials told Reuters that they were trying to get assurances from the U.K. and Sweden that Assange would not be sent to the U.S. Ecuador has also offered to allow Swedish officials to question Assange at the embassy. WikiLeaks has hired high-profile Spanish lawyer Baltasar Garzon to defend Assange if the need arises. Another activist is also getting international attention. Paul Watson, the founder of the environmental group Sea Shepherd, recently fled Germany, skipping bail after being arrested on a 10-year warrant for alleged involvement in the disruption of a Costa Rican shark finning operation. Watson had been under official supervision for more than 2 months, but fled after he learned Japan had also filed an extradition request with Germany. The Washington State-based Sea Shepherd has often confronted Japanese whalers in the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary. The group says Watson feared that if he were extradited to Costa Rica, the country would be willing to then send him to Japan to face charges. The situation is still tense in Anaheim, California today after police shot and killed 2 men last weekend. In the outrage that followed, police then opened fire on protesting residents of a Latino community with less lethal rounds, injuring several people. Further violent protests followed on Tuesday night after a large group gathered in front of City Hall. Albert Castillo with Chicanos Unidos of Orange County was among the protesters.
Things are getting worse. It's really hard to try to, you know, bring the community together when the cops keep killing young people. If you go around here, right now, it looks like a military state here in the city of Anaheim.
Now activists are mobilizing online. The group Anonymous released a video calling attention to the incident.
Anonymous are calling yet again to the citizens of the United States to rise up in unison and defeat this government which values no lives nor freedom.
And launched what they're calling Operation Anaheim on Thursday, publishing the home address of the Anaheim police chief. Today, the mayor of the city was expected to meet with Federal Justice Department and FBI officials about the initial shooting. The Orange County DA is also looking into the case. Further on-the-ground protests are planned this weekend around the city. Economic numbers out today show the pace of growth of the U.S. economy slowed last quarter to 1.5%. Acting Commerce Secretary Rebecca Blank said the growth in the GDP was a sign of the continuing recovery of the U.S. economy, citing 12 quarters in a row of continued growth. But the 1.5% expansion will not likely be enough to lower the unemployment rate. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Today, the Olympic Games officially open in London, and as athletes and fans from around the world converge in England, protesters are also drawing attention to the corporate role in the Games, the multi-billion dollar costs of the events, and labor violations. Protesters held a die-in outside the Olympic Park today to draw attention to Dow Chemicals, a major sponsor of the Olympics, and its role in the ongoing Bhopal gas disaster in India. Taxi drivers also protested what they called unfair special lanes in the city during the event. For more, we're joined by Julian Chain with the Counter Olympics Network, one of the organizers of a rally tomorrow in London. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you very much.
Your organization has criticized what it calls a corporate takeover of the Games in London. What do you mean by that?
Well, the Olympics claims to be a kind of ethical, humanitarian setup, which is meant to bring people together and so on. In reality, the Olympics is, the IOC, is a brand. In fact, Lord Coe, the head of LOCOG in Britain, he calls the Olympics the product of the IOC. And the IOC is entirely connected now with big corporations. One of the things that the Olympics enable cities to do is to kind of display their wares to the corporate world. The big cities, the great cities of the world, are now involved in a sort of competition for attention. So what we have here is this opportunity for corporations to do this. So they put in a relatively small amount of money. In London, they put in $700 million to sponsor the London Olympics, but they're going to get $600 million back in terms of tax rebates and so on. Of course, there's also funding which goes direct to the IOC, another $700 million. But when you consider that Sky has come up with a figure of $24 billion is the cost for the Olympics in London, this is really a pretty small total.
Well, $24 billion, as you say. Let's talk a moment about the numbers. The Department of Trade and Industry has said that the cost of the Games have been around £9 billion. It also said this week that the Games could bring in about $13 billion for a profit of £4 billion. Now, that's according to the government. That's projections as well. Talk about those numbers, those figures.
That is simply rubbish. I mean, first of all, you have to remember the first figure was $2.37 billion. Then it went up to $9.34 billion. Now, the $9.34 billion does not include the cost of acquiring the land. It doesn't include the cost of remediating the land. The remediation is another story. But Sky has put those figures in because they are claimed by the Olympics. If you take those figures out, you have a figure of somewhere around about $17 billion in terms of all the security, all the government expenditure that's going on, all the different departments that are spending things. But even the government acknowledges, even if you take that out, they acknowledge they haven't even put the figure for acquiring the land and remediating the land in. Now, as for these projections about getting all this money back again, to be quite blunt, this is eyewash. This kind of statement comes out, like for a little while ago, the previous Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, was saying that you're going to create 50,000 jobs as a result of the Olympics. I asked the London Development Agency, which was the body responsible for getting this project going, what this referred to. They said, treat this with caution. What Mr. Brown is talking about is that in 2042, 30 years' time, a job which might be created might be called a legacy job. These figures are just plucked out of the air for public consumption. The reality is that The Olympics costs money, and it brings in very little in return.
Another criticism of your coalition has been the privatization of public space. Now, you talked about the Olympic grounds and the changes there. Talk about your event tomorrow.
Right. Well, yes. I mean, you see, the Olympics involves creating a park. This is what the IOC requires. And this is the other thing that cities, you might say, think this is a good thing, because property is a big driver of the economy in Britain. So the Olympics is about taking land, and it means removing the people who were there, the East Londoners, the jobs that were there, the facilities that were there. And the Olympic Park will be run by an organization which belongs to the Mayor of London. And this is going to be a special project to create this kind of island of development. And how exactly, who is going to own this land remains open to question, but it is almost certainly going to be some kind of private area. Our demonstration is designed to draw attention to these things, because in London and in Britain as a whole, actually the public is not really convinced by this. 50% of the public now say that they're not sure that they should have bid for the Games. There's a slight majority inside of London and a majority outside of London say we shouldn't. 20% think that there are going to be benefits for them in the Olympics. That's not really very good after years and years of propaganda and spin. So our march is to express that opinion and to give it voice, and hopefully that it will be broadcast around the world.
And will you be watching the opening ceremonies tonight?
Well, strangely enough, I may. Not because I want to, but because I've just been invited by a BBC program to go and sit on a panel and discuss the opening ceremony. Actually, I've never watched an opening ceremony before in my life, so this is going to be a first. And it's not particularly because I plan to go there, it's because I've been invited to comment on it by a BBC program.
Okay. So it'll be interesting to hear your comments and others on that panel. Julian Chain is with Counter Olympics Network. He joined us from London. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Today, the International AIDS Conference wraps up in Washington, D.C., where health experts, policymakers, and people living with HIV are discussing how to improve and expand treatment and eradicate the disease. There are more than 1 million people in the U.S. living with HIV. Many at the conference are drawing attention to one of the groups most affected, gay black men. The Black AIDS Institute's new report, Back of the Line, details the effects on this population and calls for action. FSRN's Nesmith Savadoff has more.
It's been 2 years since President Obama came out with a national AIDS strategy, the nation's first ever comprehensive roadmap to fighting AIDS. The strategy set out to reduce new HIV infections, increase access to care, and reduce HIV-related health disparities. Health advocates commend the attention the Obama administration brought to the domestic battle against the epidemic, but many are concerned that political gridlock could weaken the plan. At issue as well is where to focus the funds and programs. Julie Schofield from the National Alliance of State and Territorial AIDS Directors says that current levels of funding are not adequate for the amount of work that must be done to end the epidemic.
Increased funding is clearly needed for prevention, to restore funding cuts to the 40 health departments that occurred in this fiscal year, to expand HIV testing and linkage to care and adherence in care, to expand the reach of activities targeting gay men of all races and ethnicities, and to expand services to the highest impacted populations. We also have to shore up our HIV surveillance programs that are critical to monitoring the epidemic and that will help us measure our success in meeting the goals of the strategy.
One goal that has gone unmet is the AIDS Drug Assistance Program, which as of July 5th had a waiting list of over 2,000 people in 9 states. Schofield estimates that the cost of that unmet need is $190 million. Another advocate, Ronald Johnson of AIDS United, says treatment is critical as it allows many living with HIV to have active, productive lives.
Over 75% of HIV-positive people who are diagnosed, who are linked to, and remain in care, and who receive proper drug treatment, achieve the goal of having a suppressed viral load. Care and treatment can result in successful health outcomes for HIV-positive individuals.
People with HIV will also benefit from the new healthcare reform law, which prevents insurance companies from discriminating against people with so-called pre-existing conditions. Now that the Supreme Court has upheld the Affordable Care Act as constitutional, Johnson and other activists are calling on Congress and state governments to implement the act in full.
Full and sustained implementation of the Affordable Care Act will increase significantly access to healthcare for all low-income people through expansion of Medicaid to those with incomes at or below 133% of the federal poverty level.
At this week's Global HIV/AIDS Conference, groups are also focusing on the communities that are disproportionately affected by the disease. The Black AIDS Institute says the country has failed to respond to high rates of the disease among gay black men. According to their new report, Back of the Line, 1 in 4 black gay men are infected with HIV by the time they reach 25. That number goes up to 60% by age 40. President of the Institute, Phil Wilson, who became infected with HIV himself when he was 24, says the time to end AIDS is now, but stressed the need for everyone's participation.
Urgent action is needed if we're going to end the AIDS epidemic in America, if we're going to reach an AIDS-free generation. We cannot do that without bringing black gay and black MSMs along the way.
After the release of the report, the director of CDC's National Center for HIV/AIDS, Kevin Fenton, urged leaders and health advocates to prioritize this demographic.
The mindset has to change that black gay men are not simply a fringe group in the fight against HIV/AIDS. They're not simply a part of the black epidemic or a part of the gay epidemic in the United States. They are, in fact, at the center of our nation's epidemic. And we cannot achieve an AIDS-free generation or the end of AIDS in the United States unless we make major inroads in the fight against HIV among black gay men.
Recently, the Center for Disease Control launched two new public awareness campaigns, Testing Makes Us Strong, which is the first CDC-funded national campaign focusing on HIV testing for black gay men, and Let's Stop HIV Together, which focuses on fighting stigma and complacency, with posters of people from all walks of life standing with their partners, family, and friends. The CDC is also scaling up HIV testing amongst black gay men and channeling funding dedicated to prevention into the 12 hardest-hit jurisdictions, including Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, and Atlanta, which account for almost 50% of new infections. Nesmith Savadoff, FSRN, Washington.
Next month, Tampa will host the Republican National Convention, and ahead of the event, the city has passed strict measures to control public protests. Activists are still planning actions, and some have already begun. Supporters of the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign are slowly setting up an encampment they're calling Romneyville. As FSRN's Janelle Irwin reports, it's an effort to make the Tampa Bay area accessible to protesters and safe for people seeking refuge.
Tampa's Romneyville was inspired by the shanty towns that sprung up during the 1930s. Bruce Wright came up with the idea.
A lot of the homeless community and poor people are going to be displaced and persecuted anyway during this time frame, and so this is also a safe haven for them.
Like the Hoovervilles of the Depression, the space is a shelter for poor people. But Wright says it's also a protest of government failures.
Much of the new homeless today are as a result of the current economic situation of job loss and foreclosures. So the same kind of issues that drove people to have to live in tents in the 30s is the same thing that's driving people to live in tents and creating tent communities really around the country. Even before the whole phenomena of Occupy emerged, there were tent cities.
Tampa's Romneyville only has a handful of residents so far who come and go mostly by rides from friends. The camp started with just a few hot pink tents given to the group by an unnamed donor. Wright expects their numbers to grow to accommodate some 250 people during the Republican National Convention. To keep things legit, the group is renting the land from a private owner.
Because we wanted the security of, not having to deal with being evicted from a public park, which still, to me, is a crazy thing that they've done that.
The organizers have developed a set of guidelines for Romneyville residents. They've already banned two individuals for spreading rumors that could have led to threats. On-site coordinator Harry, who asked that his last name not be used, says they also will not tolerate anyone who promotes violence.
We do not accept any type of destructive or violent behaviors here and while we're out and about. We actually, when that happens, we got no affiliation with it. We are extremely peaceful, very cooperative, and these groups that come here like the anarchists, their sole intent, their sole mission is disruptive, destructive behaviors.
The site doesn't look much different from the Occupy Tampa encampment. Both have limited bathroom facilities and lack any good place to keep food. Joining forces to combat the challenges would seem like a good idea, but Wright says the Occupy message is too broad.
Our specific purpose is different. We're trying to highlight poverty, homelessness, and unemployment. The message of Occupy includes that, of course, but it's much bigger than that. So we wanted to keep the focus specific.
That argument has sparked debate about what the Occupy movement is trying to accomplish. Less than 2 miles away at the Occupy Tampa encampment in West Tampa's Voices of Freedom Park, Tristan Lear agrees with people who make the argument that Occupy is too vague, but he doesn't think that it's something to criticize.
The issues are so huge and widespread as to be crippling to any concerned citizen. If Occupy appears to lack focus, it's because so many of us want to address all of these issues.
Another difference between the encampments is their decision-making process. Like others around the world, Occupy Tampa is run by a General Assembly and uses less consensus. Lear agrees that this model is messier and slower, but they don't plan to change.
We don't necessarily run by consensus model. We have kind of like a team, a committee of people that were chosen to kind of run the encampment. As it grows, there'll be more people involved in running it. And so the way we operate is a bit different.
But back at Romneyville, Bruce Wright continues to express hesitation about the two forces uniting.
I don't think that doesn't mean that we can't work together on projects, individual projects. We don't have to use the same name to work together. You know what I mean? We still could use each other's resources.
Wright had planned to keep the location of Romneyville under wraps until their public announcement on Tuesday. But after being threatened with fines by code enforcement, the property owner at the Army-Navy surplus store in downtown Tampa is asking them to leave. According to the Tampa Bay Times, law enforcement was called, but told the owner it was a civil matter. But leaders of Romneyville say they're not going anywhere. Janelle Irwin, FSRN, Tampa.
In the Philippines, the mining industry has long been criticized for funneling millions of dollars to foreign companies and displacing local communities. Resisting mining projects can also be dangerous. Human Rights Watch has documented the killing of 3 anti-mining activists since October. This month, the Philippine military denied that paramilitary groups were involved in the murders. Now, a new government policy on the mining industry, Executive Order 79, aims to balance the rights of Filipinos with extractive companies and increase the government's share of mining revenue. But environmentalists say the plan falls short of protecting tribal people, fisher folk, and the environment. FSRN's Madonna Varola reports.
Mining has long been controversial in the Philippines. Environmental and religious groups strongly oppose mining because of its negative impacts on the environment and human health. But many government officials say it brings economic benefits to the country. Leo Hazareno is director of the Mines and Geosciences Bureau of the Department of Environment and Natural Resources. He says the president's mining executive order focuses on 2 major concerns.
One is increasing the government share from mining, increasing benefits that government and communities are supposed to get from mining. The second is enhancing environmental standards to address issues of social acceptability, to address complaints and misconceptions against mining, to address present complaints against delinquencies, violations of the mining law. So both environmental and economic.
An estimated 28,000 people are employed in large-scale mining and more in small-scale mining, according to Hazareno. And around 30 mining companies operate in the country, accounting for about 6% of the country's total exports. Hazareno says the executive order addresses the gaps in the 1995 Mining Act, which environmentalists have protested against because they say it favors foreign mining companies rather than local communities.
It is expected that given an extractive industry, by its very nature, mining is controversial. So you have so many stakeholders with diverse advocacies, causes. So the intention of arriving at a middle ground is known to government that it will be hard to find. But the point is, government would just want to make it known that the policy direction is clear. To the investment, government would want to say that it is now predictable and clear. So you have a stable investment regime. And government is ready to defend the mining EO.
But mining activists are skeptical of the new policy. 2012 Goldman awardee Father Edwin Garrigues says the president's order is more focused on raising government tax revenues from the industry and does not really respond to the rights of the local communities.
This is one effective measure by which the national government can have absolute power to tie the hands of the local government. And because we know that the national government and the DIN are there, and they are not really representing the sentiments of the people, and they are really not actually listening to the complaints of the people, and they are more inclined to follow the business agenda of the mining companies.
Garrigues is co-convener of the Alianza Tigal Mina, a national coalition of civil society groups campaigning for responsible mining. The alliance says there are 23 large mining projects already approved despite strong opposition from local residents, which include tribal people, farmers, and fisherfolk. If mining projects will proceed as planned, the problems would increase, says the alliance's national coordinator J.B. Garganera.
We're going to have increased conflicts on the mine-affected sites. It's not just between the pro and the anti. We're going to see conflicts between armed groups who are also opposing corporate destructive mining, but conflicts around water resources. You're going to have a political crisis because we'll see more and more local government units who are enlightened on the huge negative impacts of mining, and a national government who will try to impose the mining priority. You're going to have increased tensions between indigenous peoples and the non-indigenous peoples.
The alliance with the influential Catholic Bishops' Conference of the Philippines have been lobbying for a moratorium on mining, the repeal of the 1995 Mining Act, and the passage of the Alternative Minerals Management Bill. Bishop Roderick Pabilio is director of the social action arm of the Catholic Bishops' Conference.
A responsible mining, that means that it's no longer just mining for profit, but how to we can manage the minerals for our own use. And at the same time, that there should be no-go zone for mining. And then the human rights situation, the cultural identities of people are to be respected.
According to the Legal Resource Center, the Alternative Mining Bill would prioritize conservation of non-renewable resources by adopting needs-based minerals management. J.B. Garganera backs this proposal because it takes into consideration future generations.
Our motivation for this campaign is not merely it's because it's an environmental case or it's a human rights case, but really, is this something that we want to leave our children? And to some extent, I think both the government, the industry also understand that the next generation will have to carry the cross or reap the benefits of the decisions we make right now, not only on the mining industry, but that is not lost to any of us. And if that's going to be a reference point for any engagement in the near future or in the midterm, I think we can move forward.
The Alternative Mining Bill is now pending in the House Committee of Natural Resources. Garganera says they will continue their work to get it passed before the Congress closes by June next year. Madonna Virola, FSRN, Manila and Quezon City, Philippines.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.